This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Bare knuckle, hard nosed, take no prisoners. Thus far, this presidential election's been a bruiser on all fronts. Ads from within the campaigns have attacked the opposing candidate on everything from Medicare to defense priorities.
President Bush signed the Patriot Act, giving law enforcement vital tools to fight terrorism. John Kerry, he voted for the Patriot Act, but pressured by fellow liberals, he's changed his position. While wiretaps
George Bush, $200 billion for Iraq. In America, lost jobs and rising health care costs. George Bush's wrong choices have weakened us here at home.
Outside official channels, independent interest groups took up the cudgels to smear both candidates' military service.
John Kerry has not been honest about what happened in Vietnam.
He is lying about his record.
I know John Kerry is lying about his first Purple Heart because I treated him for that injury.
I heard George Bush get up and say, I served in the 187th Air National Guard in Montgomery, Alabama. Really? You know, that was my unit. And I don't remember seeing you there.
The attacks come from all sides, from within the campaigns and without. For voters who try to separate the substantive from the spurious on the road to November, figuring out the candidates' actual positions can be pretty trying. But while opinion polls tell us the public doesn't like negative campaigns, often they don't vote that way. With 7 weeks to Election Day, the gloves are long since off. So how do the campaigns manage their message? What are the risks and advantages of going negative? Later this hour, we'll take a look at the latest offerings for the literary partisan's bedside table, and we have an email challenge for you. What's the one book everyone should read before Election Day? Our address is totn@npr.org. But first, negative campaigning. We can imagine how you feel about attacks on the candidate of your choice, but what about those that come from your side? Do you think there are instances where your party has crossed the line? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And that email address again is totn@npr.org. Our first guest is Matthew Dowd, chief strategist for Bush-Cheney 2004 re-election campaign. He joins us from the Bush-Cheney headquarters in Arlington, Virginia, and it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Both campaigns are attacking each other pretty solidly at the moment. Is there a concern that this could turn voters off, or is part of the idea of negative campaigning to turn off a segment of the vote?
No, I mean, I actually think, and I'll speak to what the Bush-Cheney or the RNC has done, we've tried to keep the choices that are between the two candidates based upon their records, not on some personal attack or something that might have happened 30 years ago, but upon what their records say about who they'd be as president. So when we do compare and contrast, I think it's voters are find it useful and readily accept it because it's something that they think it reflects who people would be as leaders. And when you look at previous histories, as long as campaigns stay on that level, I think voters are engaged. And in a lot of cases, turnout is higher because they have more information about the candidate's records.
Well, obviously, criticizing the other candidate's position on an issue, people call that criticism. Of course, it's a negative approach. But some people say that what they're hearing when the facts don't always agree or when they're manipulated, that isn't always fair.
Well, I put a lot of stock, and I think voters can discern what they think is important and what they have an ability to find out with today's technology and the amount of information they get, who is providing a credible contrast and who's not. And that's why I think when you present it as a reflection of a candidate's record and what that might mean as a leader or their own position statements, I think voters find that fair game. But I have a lot of confidence that voters can weed through a lot of what they hear and figure out for themselves what they think is important in a president.
What's too low? Personal attacks?
I mean, from my perspective, and this is a campaign that's never going to do that. My perspective is that your record as a leader, whether you were a governor like President Bush was or a senator like John Kerry is totally fine to talk about and what that might mean as a leader of the country, and how does that compare and contrast with your rhetoric? So, you know, we welcomed it. We were fine running on our record as governor, and, you know, the Gore campaign did a lot of criticisms of it. We didn't think that was unfair. We talked it through. I think the problem is you have a candidate for the Democratic Party that doesn't want to talk about his Senate record, and so every time we bring it up, they somehow clarified it as a you know, an unfair negative attack. We're the only ones talking about a Senate record.
Well, they say you don't have any issues to run on, and therefore you don't have all you can do is attack Senator Kerry's record. This could go back and forth all day long. The question is, what do the voters get out of it?
Well, we think there's two parts of the campaign. There's the part which we have done every single day and every single speech the president's given, and nearly half the ads that we've run on what the president has done and what he will do in the next 4 years. But this is a choice. Presidential elections are always choices. So it's not only what you will do and what you've done, but compare that with the other candidate, in this case John Kerry, and what he's done. And I think voters need to decide between those choices. It's always elections about choices. It's always been that way. And we think we've been fair about that. We've only talked about his record, or we've repeated words he said on the campaign trail as a reflection of who he'd be. And you know, we're going to run on both. It's a campaign about what your own record is and what you want to do in the next 4 years, as well as your opponents.
A lot of people would say, and Vice President Cheney has come out with a clarification of his remarks the other day when he seemed to be saying that if people vote for John Kerry, they're inviting another a terrorist attack. Was that too far?
Well, what he said was, and it's unfortunate that the news media clipped it only on part of it. What he said was, if you continued on, he said, was it, if that happened and Senator Kerry was in office, then he would not respond the way that he needed to respond. He'd respond in a law enforcement way as opposed to a military way in this war on terror. That's what he said. He got clipped off when he finished his sentence. We have an attack and we wouldn't respond the way we need to respond in this war on terror. And so I think that's totally justifiable, a discussion to have about who's better and who will defend the country in the more effective, appropriate way. And I think that's is, you know, very important to talk about.
One thing that neither campaign controls is what some of the outside groups, the 527 so-called groups, are advertising in terms of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, or now Texans for Truth, on the other side. Yet if the election were held today, people would say the most effective commercial and the one that really changed minds was Swift Boat Veterans for Truth.
Well, I think that's actually a misread of what happened. I mean, there's much too much play on the effect of the Swift Boat Veterans ad. John Kerry's support began dropping immediately after his convention, not during the midst of the Swift Boat Veterans. I think the problem that Senator Kerry had and the Democrats had is they held a convention and the only thing they talked about was something that happened 30 years ago. And I do think it's unfortunate we have these 527s. The president and the RNC and our side has tried to do everything possible to force the FEC to stop them, to regulate them, and now we're in federal court trying to stop them.
They're trying to stop you too, but yeah.
Well, yeah, and they're trying to, you know, but the problem is that John Kerry was fine with the first 47 ads that were aired by 527s, all on his side attacking the president. It was the 48th ad that he didn't like, and he wanted to ban that one. But he's not come out against any other ad except the one he didn't like. And, you know, as I've said, we'd just as soon have these 527s regulated. They're not today. It's unfortunate, but the biggest beneficiary of it has been the Kerry campaign.
Matthew Dowd, thanks very much for being with us today.
Glad to be here. Thank
Matthew
you.
Matthew Dowd is the chief strategist for the Bush-Cheney reelection campaign. He was with us from their headquarters in Arlington. Joining us now from Washington is Tad Devine, chief strategist for the Kerry Edwards campaign. And it's nice of you to join us as well.
Good to be with you, Neil.
This weekend, the New York Times reported on a debate within the Kerry campaign about whether the tone has been hard enough. Are we about to see a change of tactics?
No. Like any campaign, I've been on a number of presidential campaigns in this country and around the world. We just debate strategies within our midst, and we have a lot of discussions about it. But I don't think you're going to see a change of much of anything. I mean, John Kerry and John Edwards are going to continue to talk about why we need to take this nation in a new direction. They're going to talk about the failures of the president's policies, particularly as it pertains to $200 billion being spent today in Iraq that is being spent there and should be spent here to deal with issues like jobs and health care and the other pressing domestic priorities. I think we're reaching a natural point of engagement in this campaign where there will be contrast on the issues, and I expect we'll have a lot of that in the weeks ahead.
Yet James Carville, who's just joined up with the campaign as a consultant, is quoted as saying Republicans are better at attack politics, and he's going to be brought on board to change that a little bit.
Well, James is a great friend, and we've worked together on a lot of campaigns in this country and around the world, and he's always got a very aggressive tone, and we admire him for it, and we welcome his input. I don't think he's going to leave his post as a moderator of a TV show. He's going to be here and give us a lot of advice, and he and others have done so for many months. We welcome their input and advice. We've got a great group group of people in the Democratic Party. Our party is very diverse. It represents a lot of different viewpoints. So I expect you'll see a very aggressive campaign from us between now and the election, because there are big issues at stake. I mean, there are real differences on the issues, and I think the voters want to know about these differences, particularly as they pertain to subjects like Iraq, where there is huge differences between the candidates, the economy, where John Kerry has a real plan to invigorate the economy, to end outsourcing, for example, that President Bush now supports, to have real health care reform so that the 45 million Americans who today have no health insurance coverage can have a chance at that, to cut the costs. We've seen health care costs skyrocket, 50% increases since George Bush has been president. So these are real issues, and there's real differences, and we want to debate on these issues.
From a tactical point of view, if you're presenting a candidate who's not so well known to the American public, the first round of Kerry commercials, certainly the thrust of the convention was to explain who John Kerry is, tell his life story. From a tactical point of view, does it make more sense for the Republicans to be more interested in probing Senator Kerry's record?
Well, I don't think they have a choice. I mean, there is no way for the president to talk about the last 4 years and win the election. I mean, what is he going to do? Say, well, it's great that I'm the first president since Herbert Hoover not to have net job creation since I took office. He can't talk about health care because of the cost skyrocketing and millions of Americans losing health insurance since he's been president. Energy independence, which allegedly the vice president was in charge of, has resulted in the highest gasoline prices in history. I mean, the president's policies have been an abject failure. So as a result of that, the only thing he can do is what he's done since the beginning of March, run the most relentlessly negative campaign in the history of the world. And, you know, that's what
they're
doing.
The history of the world?
Absolutely the world. When we measure it by dollars spent, I don't think anyone could compete with the amount of negativity from George Bush. And I don't think he's really had a choice. I mean, what is he going to do? Say, I've had 4 years, I've got nothing done, give me four more? I mean, he doesn't really have much of an option. So we understand why he's doing it. And I think the American people understand, too. They have a choice. Do we want to continue the policies of the last 4 years, continue on the course that we're on today, mm-hmm. or do we want to go in a new direction? I think it's a very clear choice, and I think the American people have repeatedly said they think this nation's on the wrong track. Overwhelmingly, they say the president does not deserve re-election. More people think he's done a bad job than done a good job, and I think with an incumbent president, that's really the measure, and I think that's why he's going to lose.
Well, let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255, email totn@npr.org. Let's talk with Floyd in Ottumwa, Iowa.
Well, thank you, Neil. You're an honored guest. My name is Floyd Henry from Ottumwa, and I just spoke with some folks we had at a rally here for Democratic candidate John Kerry in Ottumwa, Iowa. Folks I spoke with, we want our candidate to get in there and just get start fighting back, getting negative with him. These negative attacks on John Kerry are not good at all, but to try to be nice and polite, that's not going to work.
Democrats
negative, and we encourage candidate Kerry.
Are Democrats too nice, Tad Devine?
Well, I don't think we're too nice. I mean, I think what Floyd's saying is right. You know, this is a real contest. I think the Bush campaign has demonstrated that they're prepared to be relentlessly negative. I think it's important for our side to fight back. One of the things that people in Iowa have not seen in recent weeks, but they will be seeing, and they're seeing now just in recent days, is a very important part of our campaign, which is television advertising. We made a decision after our convention not to broadcast our own campaign paid media for a period of almost 5 weeks. That's because our general election was 13 weeks long, and the president's was 8 weeks long. We both received the same amount of money. We wanted to be there at the end of the race. We're up on television now, and I think in Iowa you'll see an ad right now which challenges the president on the $200 billion he's spending in Iraq and not dealing with the problems here at home. So I think Floyd and others are going to be seeing a very aggressive campaign. We didn't run it in August. We made a deliberate choice, but we will be there very heavy with television advertising in Iowa and other battleground states all the way to the end.
Tad Devine, thanks very much.
Nice to be with you.
Tad Devine, chief strategist for the Kerry Edwards campaign. He was with us from their headquarters here in Washington, D.C. Well, when we get back from the break, we'll talk about the effect that negative campaigning has on voters. Has the tone of the election this year made you more interested in voting or less? We'll take more of your calls as well. 800-989-8255. And don't forget the email challenge. What's the one political book everybody should read before Election Day? TOTN@npr.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the bare-knuckle tone of this year's presidential campaign. Of course, you're invited to join us. 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. In a Newsweek poll released this week, one quarter of registered voters say that both campaigns have been too negative thus far. Despite the millions of dollars the campaigns pour into attacks on each other, conventional political science has long held that negative campaigning drives down voter turnout come Election Day. That view, though, is starting to change. Joining us now to talk about bare-knuckle politics from a voter's eye view is Paul Friedman, professor of political science at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, and good to have you on the program.
Thank you, Neil.
From your studies, what effect does negative campaigning have on voters?
Well, we've found over the course of several different elections that, as Matthew Dowd suggested a few moments ago, negative campaigning and negative advertising in particular conveys a series of real democratic benefits. Exposure to negative advertising, for example, increases citizens' interest in the campaign. It raises the level of voter learning about the candidates and their positions. And in a variety of different electoral contexts, we've found again and again that where there is more negative advertising, there are higher levels of voter turnout.
Why do negative ads have seem to have, in that case, more of an effect on voters than positive ones?
Well, if you think about it, it makes a good deal of sense. Negative appeals are striking. They're memorable. People tend to pay more attention to negative information and negative campaign messages. People are motivated to avoid risky situations, to avoid losses. And negative appeals tend to call their attention to the risks involved in a particular choice. And so negative ads and negative campaigning conveys a good deal of memorable information that people bring to bear on Election Day.
Well, one of the basic questions about negative campaigning or negative advertising, aspects of the same thing, their fairness. And one curiosity is, here's a letter from an email we got from Glenn in Mason, Michigan. Can media markets refuse to run negative ads, and why don't they? The answer is no, they can't, and there is no referee in these.
Exactly. There's no legal referee, but I would suggest that there is a set of de facto referees in the form of the opposing candidate and his or her campaign, in the form of the media, and in the form of academic watchdogs who have been doing, in my view, really an excellent job at checking the facts, at bringing to light the truth or the falsehood of particular allegations or charges. And I think that that's an important, really a critical part of the process of a campaign.
Well, let's get some more listeners involved. Stanley's with us from Folsom, California.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment that I think that the negative campaigning is beginning to influence the electorate. I've done I read the Sacramento Bee every day, and I can tell you that if you just count the negative words between obvious Republicans and obvious Democrats writing into the letters to the editor, you will find that very many inflammatory words. Republicans use certain keywords and Democrats use other keywords, but traitor, immoral.
Stanley? I think Stanley's cell phone has betrayed him, but I think we got the thrust of his question there, Paul Friedman.
Sure. I think part of how we evaluate this, I think, depends upon what we think democracy should be about. Is politics a hard-hitting clash of different ideas? Should candidates call attention to what they see as the flaws, the dangers, the risks of their opponents? I would argue that this is what democracy is all about. Democracy isn't a tea party. It's rough, it's messy, it's nasty, and it's important. I would suggest that candidates have not just a right to bring to light the flaws and the shortcomings of their opponents as they see it, but really an obligation to make that case to the voters.
Yeah, we heard for a long time that, negative campaigning does drive down the turnout, but it drives down the turnout in your opponent's camp.
Well, this has been an ongoing debate for people who follow politics and people who study politics for some time. And as with any debates, where you stand depends upon where you sit, what your beginning assumptions are about what democracy should look like, and how you think it makes sense to not just practice democracy, but to study it. And so really one of the interesting things about politics is that there is a range of different approaches that people bring, not only to practicing it, but to studying it. it, and as we've changed our methodologies for learning about the impact of political messages on voter attitudes and behavior, we've had some new perspectives on what the impact of these kinds of charges and these kinds of advertisements might be.
Let's talk now with Mary. She's on the phone from Hyattsville, Maryland.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm primarily a Democratic-leaning voter, but I've watched both the Democratic and Republican conventions this year. I was very struck by how both of them spent almost no time building up their own party or their own plan, and was basically just saying that if you elect the other person, the world is going to end, and they are completely unfit to govern. I think that this, for someone who follows politics, it becomes very tedious and sort of stops serving the purpose of informing the voters, because you've already heard everything negative you can possibly hear, it seems like, about these candidates, and you really just want to hear what are they going to do, how mm-hmm. are they going to respond to that.
And Mary, is that, do you think, going to affect how you plan to vote?
I think it's more just affecting my, I'm just tired of hearing, I don't want to hear any more information about the election at this point. I think I've made up my mind, and all the negative ads just make me want to turn off the TV and throw away my mail.
Well, all right. That leads to the question. Thank you, Mary, by the way, very much. We appreciate the call. What's too much? When is too low too low? When is too much, Paul Friedman?
Yeah, Neil, Mary makes a good point, and a lot of people have precisely that reaction. But as you noted earlier, there's often a discrepancy between what people say they think about negative ads and what they may actually feel about negativity in political campaigns generally, and how they actually respond to it. And so, again, our evidence suggests that people really do respond and become engaged when they hear these sorts of appeals, when they hear these kinds of attacks. I'd also point out that Mary, by her own admission, is not a typical voter. She is somebody who follows politics very, very carefully and regularly. And for others, people who may be more difficult to reach or to engage, negative appeals may do a better job at bringing them in. And indeed, the evidence from this campaign suggests that certainly compared to 4 years ago, people are more interested, they're more engaged, they're paying closer attention, and they think that the choice matters more than it did in 2000.
Let's talk with Paul. Paul's calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to make some comments, and I was hoping that I might get a response out of you also. First of all, I'm typically a Republican. I'm only 22 years old. But what I really want to comment on is the fact that I think the main reason why this campaign or both campaigns are focusing so much on this negative stuff between each other is because they're avoiding the issues. The war on terrorism and the war in Iraq is very visible, and you can comment on that either way and be right in a sense. But the real stuff that people want to hear about, like health care and Social Security, are being avoided.
Health care, Social Security, the deficit, these are all extremely difficult questions, Paul Friedman. Are they going on the attack to avoid speaking about them?
Well, I can't speak to their motives, but it certainly is the case that there are certain big-ticket charges, big-ticket types of attacks that are easier to make and to sustain and to use in an effort to capture the attention and the imagination of voters, as opposed to more detailed policy types of questions. And so I guess I would concur with the sense that that's one of the implications. However, another response is that here's where the referees come in. This is the role of the media, of academic watchdogs, to put pressure on the candidates and the campaigns to make their stances and their positions known. It's also the role of debates, and we will have a series of debates, how many remains to be seen, but that will be an opportunity for the voters to see the candidates on their feet.
If I could also comment that on the flip side of that, when they do finally take a stance as far as if they believe or disbelieve in abortion and gay marriages and so on, when they actually take that stance, then they take the risk of losing those votes to the people that believe in the other side.
Yeah, that's true enough, Paul, but they've both taken those stances. They're very well known.
True.
Yeah. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
I would just add to that we live in a world now where information is more readily accessible than ever before, and if anybody wants to find out the stance of either of these or any of these candidates on any position, it's just a few mouse clicks away.
Joining us now is Democratic strategist Gary South. He was senior advisor on Joseph Lieberman's primary campaign this year and ran several campaigns for former California Governor Gray Davis. He joins us from his office in Santa Monica, California. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be your guest today.
You've run some pretty hard-nosed campaigns in your time. From the point of view of a strategist, is this something you eagerly embrace, or is this something you only respond to the other scoundrels' campaigns reluctantly?
Well, I think you have to look at the environment in which we run campaigns in this day and age, because we have an electorate that is very cynical about politicians, about politics in general. And you can argue whether that's a chicken and egg syndrome, whether negative campaigning has turned off the voters to the point that they're cynical, or whether because you have cynical voters, negative campaigns are the way to go, because it's the only thing that really you can use to impact voters. But here's the dilemma that political professionals have in today's political environment. Voters always say they don't like negative ads. Every time I've done a focus group, and I've done hundreds of them since I got involved in politics 32 years ago,
mm-hmm.
whenever you throw a negative ad at folks in a focus group, they say they don't like it, they get turned off, they say that's mudslinging, that's what I hate about politics, and anyone who uses ads like that will not get my vote. But the fact of the matter is, we know the negative advertising works, and that's why it's used. And so to some degree, you can blame the politicians, you can blame the candidates, you can blame the consultants, I suppose, and I'm certainly willing to come in for my share of the blame here. But the voters are complicit in this as well, because, frankly, they're so cynical about politicians that when you try to run positive ads and you try to talk about a candidate's record or you try to talk about their vision for the future, the same people in the focus groups who tell you they don't like negative ads also don't believe a word of what you're saying in your positive spots. So the question arrives, what do you do?
Does the cycle of tit-for-tat sort of accelerate itself? I mean, not only within one campaign cycle, but you can sit around for 4 years and say, we're going to get them next time, 6 years if it's a Senate campaign.
Well, sure, and there is a vicious cycle here to some degree, but it's not done in a vacuum. It's not done because consultants are evil or political candidates are craven and we don't want to say anything good about themselves, but simply want to tear down the opposition. I mean, the fact of the matter is, historically, as you know, the dirty work in campaigns for the first 150 or so years of this democracy was basically done by newspapers that were essentially party organs. They were salacious. They were completely over the top if you go back and look at some of the charges that were made by those newspapers about opposition candidates all the way back to the beginning of the Republic, about Jefferson, about Adams, about Washington. But once papers became supposedly objective purveyors of the news and were geneticized, if you will, the function of carrying out those kinds of attacks shifted to the campaigns and the candidates themselves. That may not be a healthy development, but it's a fact. It's a historical fact, and it's something that you have to look at in terms of assessing whether today's campaigns are, in fact, more negative than campaigns earlier in our history. I would argue they're not, partly because of what you were just talking about, which is that the media has turned from the role of being party attack dog on behalf of the candidates of the party that owned or controlled those newspapers, lock, stock, and barrel, to being a watchdog to determine whether or not ads that are put on the air are in fact factual. And I think that the truth boxes, as they become known in our profession, that newspapers now do, and sometimes even television stations now do, on ads that are put up on the air are a big public service. And I think that the function of who carries out the negative attacks in a campaign has clearly shifted in this nation's history from outside organs that kept the candidates clean to directly inside the candidate's campaign. And you can argue about whether that's a good development or a bad development, but it is in fact a fact.
We're talking with Gary South and with Paul Friedman about negative advertising and negative campaigning. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's bring another listener into the conversation. Adam is with us from Pomfret, Vermont.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I wanted to follow up on a question that you asked. It was the first thing that you asked early in the program.
Mm-hmm.
How low is too low? And it seems to me that there's an answer to that question that you didn't get. The answer is, you know, too low is fabrication. And although there's a certain amount of spinning that takes place in all campaigns, you know, the voters need to distinguish between spinning that is just sort of fudging versus you know, an actual fabrication or creation or storytelling. And it's the fabrication and storytelling that people find to be a turnoff and disgusting.
Lying then is your line in the sand, Adam?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Let's get a response. Paul Friedman, is that a reasonable position that people shouldn't lie about each other in their political advertisements? Hello, Paul. We apparently lost
Paul. Can you hear Friedman? Hello.
Hello. Is this Paul Friedman?
Speaking.
Good. All right.
I'm back.
Okay.
It's absolutely the case. I think that one can draw a line, perhaps even before lying. I might be interested in thinking about misleading voters through campaign ads or campaign charges as the standard for too low. I think candidates in a democracy have an obligation to be truthful and should be held accountable for making misleading charges. And again, this suggests the important role for media and other watchdogs. There may be an unintended consequence that's worth mentioning, however, about the ad watches that are becoming more common, and that is it's possible, for example, that many people who never saw the actual Swift boat ads leveled at directed at John Kerry nevertheless encountered them through ad watches on CNN or C-SPAN or other cable outlets. And so the unintended consequence is that we may actually perpetuate charges that would otherwise die a natural death in the absence of this media spotlight, but I think that's a risk worth taking.
Mm-hmm. Adam, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And I just wanted to ask Gary South, we just have a minute or so left, but these outside ads in the presidential campaign, they're the 527s, but these kinds of things appear in any big-time political race. Are they helpful or do they hurt when they come from your side?
It all depends, and it depends on the circumstances. It depends on how well they're done. It depends on whether or not they have a factual basis. I tend to think that these ads are not new, by the way. As you remember, in the 1988 presidential campaign with George Herbert Walker Bush, the now infamous Willie Horton ad was not put on the air by the Bush campaign. It was put on the air by an independent group, and it ran a very short number of days and caused a national furor, which is what Paul was referring to.
And the Daisy commercial, in which Barry Goldwater is accused of wanting a nuclear war, ran once.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
And so what the purpose of a lot of these ads is to create a furor in the press, in the free media, if you will, by running the ad a few number of times on some cable market someplace, but then trying to pump it into the mainstream by sending cassettes of it DVDs or DVDs of it out to television stations and getting free airplay. I think you have to look at a case-by-case basis to see whether these kinds of outside ads are helpful or hurtful. I do think that the Horton ad...
Gary South, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Gary South, the Democratic strategist, thank you very much. And Paul Friedman, co-author of the forthcoming book, Seeing Spots, Television Advertising and U.S. Elections. More after a break.